Chapter 62. Crisis. The next morning I made my way to Severn Low before the sun was up. I ate a hot breakfast of eggs and potatoes while I waited for an apothecary to open. When I was finished, I bought 2 more pints of cod liver oil and a few other oddments I hadn't thought of the day before. Then I walked the entire length of Tinnery Street, hoping to stumble onto Denner, despite the fact that it was far too early in the morning for her to be up and about. Wagons and farmers' carts vied for space on the cobbled streets. Ambitious beggars were laying claim to the busiest corners, while shopkeepers hung out their shingles and threw wide their shutters. I counted 23 inns and boarding houses on Tinnery Street. After making note of the ones Denner would probably find appealing, I forced myself back to the mayor's estates. This time I took the freight lifts, partly to confuse anyone following me, but also because the purse the mayor had given me was nearly empty. Since I needed to keep a normal face on things, I remained in my rooms, waiting for the mayor to send for me. I sent my card and ring to Braden, and soon he was sitting across from me, thrashing me at tack and telling stories.
So the mayor had him hung in a gibbet, right alongside the eastern gate, hung here for days, howling and cursing, saying he was innocent, saying it wasn't right and how he wanted a trial.
I couldn't quite bring myself to believe it. A gibbet? Braden nodded seriously.
An actual iron gibbet. Who knows where he managed to find one in this day and age. It was like something out of a play.
I searched for something relatively non-committal to say. While it did sound grotesque, I also knew better than to openly criticize the mayor. Well, I said, banditry is a terrible thing. Braden began to place a stone on the board, then reconsidered.
Quite a few folks thought the whole thing was in rather,
he cleared his throat,
bad taste. But nobody said so very loudly, if you catch my meaning. It was a grisly thing, but it got the point across.
He finally chose the placement of his stone and we played quietly for a time. It's a strange thing, I said. I ran into someone the other day who didn't know where Cordicus would rank in the overall scheme of things.
That's not terribly surprising,
Braden gestured to the board.
The giving and receiving of rings is a lot like attack. On the face of it, the rules are simple. In execution, they become quite complicated.
He clicked down a stone, his dark eyes crinkling with amusement.
In fact, the other day I was explaining the intricacies of the custom to a foreigner not familiar with such things.
That was kind of you, I said. Braden gave a gracious nod.
It seems simple at first glance, he said. A baron ranks above a baronet, but sometimes young money is worth more than old blood. Sometimes control of a river is more important than how many soldiers you can put to field. Sometimes a person is actually more than one person, technically speaking. The Earl of Svanis is, by strange inheritance, also the Viscount of Devon, one man but 2 different political entities.
I smiled. My mother once told me she knew a man who owed fealty to himself, I said. Owed himself a share of his own taxes every year. And if he were ever threatened, there were treaties in place demanding he provide himself with prompt and loyal military support. Braden nodded.
It happens more often than folk realize, he said, especially with the older families. Steps, for example, exists in several separate capacities.
Stapes? I asked. But he's just a manservant, isn't he?
Well,
Braden said slowly,
he is that, but he's hardly just a manservant. His family is quite old, but he has no title of his own. Technically, he ranks no higher than a cook, but he owns substantial lands. He has money, and he is the mayor's manservant. They've known each other since they were boys. Everyone knows he has Alveron's ear.
Braden's dark eyes peered at me.
Who would dare insult such a man with an iron ring? Go to his room and you will see the truth. There is nothing in his bowl but gold.
Braden excused himself shortly after our game, claiming a prior engagement. Luckily, I now had my lute to occupy my time. I set about retuning it, checking the frets and fussing over the tuning peg that was constantly coming loose. We had been away from each other for a long while, and it takes time to get reacquainted. Hours passed. I discovered myself absent-mindedly playing Dead Nettle's Lament, and forced myself to stop. Noon came and went. Lunch was delivered and cleared away. I retuned my lute and ran some scales. Before I knew it, I found myself playing Leave the Town Tinker. Only then did I realize what my hands were trying to tell me. If the mayor was still alive, he would have called for me by now. I let the lute fall silent and began to think very quickly. I needed to leave now. Stapes had seen me bring medicine to the mayor. I could even be accused of tampering with the vial I had brought from Cordicus's rooms. Slow fear began to knot my gut as I realized the helplessness of my situation. I didn't know the mayor's estates well enough to attempt a clever escape. On my way to Severn Low this morning, I'd got turned around and had to stop to ask directions. The knock on the door was louder than usual, more forceful than that of the errand boy who normally came to deliver the mayor's invitation. Guards, I froze in my seat. Would it be best to answer the door and tell the truth, or duck out of the window into the garden and somehow try to make a run for it? The knock came again, louder.
Sir, sir!
I opened the door and saw a young boy carrying a tray with the mayor's iron ring and card. I picked them up. The card had a single word written in a shaky hand. Immediately. Stapes looked uncharacteristically ragged around the edges and greeted me with an icy stare. Yesterday, he'd looked as if he wanted me dead and buried. Today, his look implied that simply buried would be good enough. The mayor's bedroom was generously decorated with Salus flowers. Their delicate smell was almost enough to cover the odors they'd been brought in to conceal. Combined with Stapes's appearance, I knew my predictions of the night's unpleasantness had been close to the truth. Alvaron was propped into a sitting position in his bed. He looked as well as could be expected, which is to say exhausted, but no longer sweating and racked with pain. As a matter of fact, he looked almost angelic. A rectangle of sunlight washed over him, lending his skin a frail translucency and making his disarrayed hair shine like a silver crown around his head. As I stepped closer, he opened his eyes, breaking the beatific illusion. No angel ever had eyes as clever as Alvaron's.
"I trust I find your grace well?" I asked politely.
"Passing fair," he responded. But it was mere social noise telling me nothing.
"How do you feel?"
I asked in a more serious tone. He gave me a long look that let me know he did not approve of my addressing him so casually, then said,
"Old. I feel old and weak."
He took a deep breath.
"But for all that, I feel better than I have in several days. A little pain, and I am mightily tired, but I feel clean. I think I've passed the crisis."
I did not ask about last night.
"Would you like me to mix you another pot of tea?"
"Please."
His tone was measured and polite. Unable to guess his mood, I hurried through the preparations and handed him his cup. He looked up at me after sampling it.
"This tastes different. There is less laudanum in it," I explained. "Too much would be harmful to your grace. Your body would begin to depend on it as surely as it craved the ophelum."
He nodded.
"You'll note my birds are doing well," he said in an overly casual tone.
I looked through the doorway and saw the sipquicks darting about in their gilded cage, lively as ever. I felt a chill at the implication of his comment. He still didn't believe Cordicus was poisoning him. I was too stunned to make a quick reply, but after a breath or two I managed to say,
"Their health does not concern me nearly so much as your own. You do feel better, don't you, Your Grace?"
"That is the nature of my illness. It comes and goes."
The mayor set down his cup of tea, still three quarters full.
Eventually it fades entirely. Encordicus is free to go off gallivanting for months at a time, gathering ingredients for his charms and potives. Speaking of, he said, folding his hands in his lap, would you do me the favor of fetching my medicine from Cordicus? Certainly, Your Grace. I stretched a smile over my face, trying to ignore the unease settling in my chest. I cleaned up the clutter I had created while fixing his tea, tucking packages and bundles of herbs back into the pockets of my burgundy cloak. The mayor nodded graciously, then closed his eyes and seemed to lapse back into his tranquil, sunlit nap.
Our fledgling historian, Cordicus said as he gestured me inside and offered me a seat. If you'll excuse me for a moment, I'll be right back.
I sank into the padded chair and only then noticed the array of rings on the nearby table. Cordicus had gone so far as to have a rack built for them. Each was displayed with the name facing outward. There were a great many of them, silver, iron, and gold. Both my gold ring and Alvaron's iron one sat on a small tray on the table. I reclaimed them, taking note of this rather graceful way of wordlessly offering the return of a ring. I looked around the large tower room with muted curiosity. What possible motive could he have for poisoning the mayor? Barring access to the university itself, this place was every arcanist's dream. Curious, I got to my feet and wandered to his bookshelves. Cordicus had a respectable library with nearly 100 books crowding for space. I recognized many of the titles. Some were chemical references, some were alchemical. Others dealt with the natural sciences, herbology, physiology, bestiology. The vast majority seemed to be historical in nature. A thought occurred to me. Perhaps I could get the native vintage superstition to work to my advantage. If Cordicus was a serious scholar and even half as superstitious as a native vint, he might know something about the Chandrian. Best of all, since I was playing the dim-witted lordling, I didn't need to worry about damaging my reputation. Cordicus came around the corner and seemed somewhat taken aback when he saw me standing by the bookshelves, but he rallied quickly and gave me a polite smile.
See anything you are interested in?
I turned, shaking my head.
Not particularly, I said. Do you know anything about the Chandrian?
Cordicus looked at me blankly for a moment, then burst out laughing.
I know they're not going to come into our room at night and steal you out of your bed,
he said, wiggling his fingers at me the way you'd tease a child.
You don't study mythology, then?
I asked, fighting down a wave of disappointment at his reaction. I tried to console myself with the fact that this would firmly solidify me as a half-wit lordling in his mind. Cordicus sniffed.
That's hardly mythology, he said dismissively. One could barely even stoop to calling it folklore. It's superstitious bunk, and I don't waste my time with it. No serious scholar would.
He began to putter around the room, restoppering bottles and tucking them into cabinets, straightening up stacks of papers and returning books to their shelves.
Speaking of serious scholarship, if I remember correctly, you were curious about the Leclerc family.
I simply stared at him for a moment. With everything that had happened since, I'd all but forgotten the pretense of the anecdotal genealogy I'd invented yesterday.
If it wouldn't be any trouble, I said quickly. As I've said, I know practically nothing of them.
Cordicus nodded seriously.
In that case, you might be well served in considering their name.
He adjusted an alcohol lamp underneath a simmering glass alembic in the midst of an impressive array of copper tubing. Whatever he was distilling, I guessed it wasn't peach brandy.
You see, names can tell you a great deal about a thing.
I grinned at that, then fought to smother the expression.
You don't say.
He turned back to face me just as I got my mouth under control.
Oh, yes, he said. You see, names are sometimes based on other older names. The older the name, the closer it lies to the truth. Leclerc is a relatively new name for the family, not much more than 600 years old.
For once, I didn't have to feign amazement.
600 years is new. The Leclerc family is old.
He stopped his pacing and settled down into a threadbare armchair.
Much older than the House of Alvaron. 1,000 years ago, the Leclerc family enjoyed a power at least as great as Elferon's. Pieces of what are now Vintas, Mordek, and a large portion of the small kingdoms were all Leclerc's lands at one point.
What was their name before that? I asked.
He pulled down a thick book and flipped its pages impatiently.
Here it is. The family was called Loiklos, or Loklos, or Loilois. They all translate the same, Lokles. Spelling was rather less important in those days.
What days were those? I asked.
He consulted the book again.
About 900 years ago, but I've seen other histories that mention the Loiklos 1,000 years before the fall of Artur.
I boggled at the thought of a family older than empires.
So the Lokles family became the Lackless family. What reason could a family have for changing its name?
There are historians who would cut off their own right hands to answer that, Cordicus said. It's generally accepted that there was some sort of falling out that splintered the family. Each piece took on a separate name. In Artur, they became the Lackey family. They were numerous but fell on hard times. That's where the word lackey comes from, you know? All those pauper nobility forced to scrape and bow to make ends meet. In the south, they became the Lackliths, who slowly spiraled into obscurity. The same with the Capecairn in Mordek. The largest piece of the family was here in Vintas, except Vintas didn't exist back then.
He closed the book and held it out to me.
You can borrow this if you'd like.
Thank you, I took the book.
You're too kind.
There was the distant sound of a belling tower.
I'm too long-winded, he said. I've talked away our time and haven't given you anything of use.
Just the history makes a great difference, I said gratefully.
Are you sure I can't interest you in a few stories from other families?
He asked, walking over to a work table.
I wintered with the Jacques family not long ago. The Baron is a widower, you know, quite wealthy and somewhat eccentric.
He raised both eyebrows at me, his eyes wide with implied scandal.
I'm sure I could remember a few interesting things if I were assured of my anonymity.
I was tempted to break character for that, but instead I shook my head.
Perhaps when I'm done working on the Lackless section,
I said with all the self-importance of someone devoted to a truly useless project.
My research is quite delicate. I don't want to get tangled up in my head.
Cordicus frowned a bit, then shrugged it away as he rolled up his sleeves and began to make the mayor's medicine. I watched him go through his preparations again. It wasn't alchemy. I knew that from watching Simon work. This was barely even chemistry. Mixing a medicine like this was closer to following a recipe than anything, but what were the ingredients? I watched him move through it step by step. The dried leaf was probably bite view. The liquid from the stoppered jar was no doubt muratum or aquafortis, some sort of acid at any rate. When it bubbled and steamed in the lead bowl, it dissolved a small amount of lead, maybe only a quarter scruple. The white powder was probably the ophelum. He added a pinch of the final ingredient. I couldn't even guess what that was. It looked like salt, but then again, almost everything looks like salt. As he went through the motions, Cordicus nattered on about court gossip. Defer's eldest son had broken his leg jumping out of a brothel window. Lady Hesua's most recent lover was illish and didn't speak a word of a Turin. There was a rumor of highwaymen on the King's Road to the north, but there were always rumors of bandits, so that was nothing new. I don't care one whit for gossip, but I can fake interest when I must. All the while, I watched Cordicus for some telltale sign, some whisper of nervousness, a bead of sweat, a moment's hesitation. But there was nothing. Not the slightest indication he was preparing a poison for the mayor. He was perfectly comfortable, utterly at ease. Was it possible he was poisoning the mayor by accident? Impossible. Any arcanist worth his guilder knew enough chemistry to... Then it dawned on me. Maybe Cordicus wasn't an arcanist at all. Maybe he was simply a man in a dark robe who didn't know the difference between an alligator and a crocodile. Maybe he was just a clever pretender who happened to be poisoning the mayor out of simple ignorance. Maybe that was peach brandy in his distillery. He tamped the cork into the vial of amber liquid and handed it to me.
"There you are," he said. "Make sure you take it to him straight away. It'll be best if he gets it while it's still warm."
The temperature of a medicine doesn't make one whit of difference. Any physicist knows that. I took the vial and pointed to his chest as if I just noticed something.
"My word, is that an amulet?"
He seemed confused at first, and drew out the leather cord from underneath his robes.
"Of sorts,"
he said with a tolerant smile. At a casual glance, the piece of lead he wore around his neck looked very much like an arcanum guilder.
"Does it protect you from spirits?"
I asked in a hushed voice.
"Oh yes," he said flippantly, "all sorts."
I swallowed nervously.
"May I touch it?"
He shrugged and leaned forward, holding it out to me. I took it timidly with my thumb and forefinger, then jumped back a step.
"It bit me,"
I said, pitching my voice somewhere between indignation and anxiety as I wrung my hand. I saw him fighting down a smile.
"Ah, yes. I need to feed it, I suspect."
He tucked it back inside his robes.
"Go on now."
He made a shooing motion toward the door. I made my way back to the mayor's rooms, trying to massage some feeling back into my numb fingers. It was a genuine arcanum guilder. He was a real arcanist. He knew exactly what he was doing. I returned to the mayor's rooms and engaged in 5 minutes of painfully formal small talk while I refilled the Flitz feeders with the still warm medicine. The birds were unnervingly energetic, humming and chirruping sweetly. The mayor sipped a cup of tea as we talked, his eyes following me quietly from the bed. When my work with the birds was finished, I made my goodbyes and left as quickly as propriety allowed. Though our conversation hadn't touched on anything more serious than the weather, I could read his underlying message as plainly as if he'd written it for me to read. He was in control. He was keeping his options open. He didn't trust me.